A sermon by Reverend Richard A. Rem, preached at Christ Community Church in Spring Lake, Michigan, on July 21, 2002, in the series Spiritual Life, Religion Reexamined, entitled To Be Human is Enough. The texts for the sermon are Ezekiel 1, verses 1 through 3 and 26 through 28, Psalm 103, Luke 15, verses 1 through 2 and 11 through 24, and a reading from the present included here. Copyright Grand Valley State University.
The reading from the present is a work by Walter Wink from a lecture that he gave, but which is expressed even more fully in his book, The Human Being. I won't read it all. It's for you to read this afternoon. Then you can go home and say, oh, that's what he was trying to say. But in the middle of the page, why then does God turn a human-like face to Ezekiel? What does it mean to say that God is revealed as human? Perhaps because becoming human is the task that God has set for human beings. And human beings have only a vague idea what it means to be human. Humanity errs in believing that it is human. We are only fragmentarily human, fleetingly human, brokenly human. We see glimpses of our humanness. We can dream of what a more humane existence and political order would be like, but we have not yet arrived at true humanness. And then in the last paragraph, only God is, as it were, human. The goal of life, then, is not to become something we are not, divine, but to become what we truly are, human. We are not required to become divine, flawless, perfect, without blemish. We are invited simply to become human, which means growing through our mistakes, learning by trial and error, being redeemed over and over from sin and compulsive behavior, becoming ourselves, scars and all. It means embracing and transforming our shadow side. It means giving up pretending to be good and instead becoming real. The shape and form of our religion is the instrument, the means through which we express our spiritual life. And I think it's important to consider our religion, our forms and structures, creedal statements, liturgies, etc. From time to time, in order to be sure that those forms and structures and formulations are an adequate vehicle for the expression of that spiritual life which is emerging within us and in constant emergence and development and hopefully growth. And so we're reflecting on religion reimagined in order that we might have an enhanced spiritual life. And last week I began autobiographically to share some of the transformations in my own understanding over the years, significant transformations to be sure. And I have been on this pilgrimage for a long time. After the first few years in the ministry, and the questions loomed large for me, and I had the rare opportunity of going away for 4 years to Europe and reading and thinking and writing and struggling with all these things, and really for the first time in my life, being open to be led wherever that would lead me, not knowing for sure where I would end up. And then coming back, having the opportunity here in this community to begin to try to articulate some of the new insights and some of the new perspectives and the new posture that I had gained in that time of study and reflection. And for me, slowly, gradually, over all that time, the retranslation has occurred. And it's not been without some pain and some difficulty and a lot of struggle, but nonetheless, here we are. And having gone through that process of translation, I think that I have come to an understanding of the religious community, which is an understanding I certainly didn't have to begin with. I said last week, I think a community like this is a cultural, linguistic community. We have a certain ambience. We have a certain way of being here, way of being together here. And we have a certain language and symbols and images, sacraments, and we have invested all of that with meaning. And when we hear certain words, when we do certain actions, when we see certain images, things trigger within us, and we have that sense that we are home, we are family, and things make sense. Now, a religious community is very resistant to change because our meaning, our life meaning, is wrapped up in those particular words and formulations and statements and professions and liturgies, etc. And so when those are tampered with, what is being tampered with really is our meaning of life and our very inward being. But if we come to see that what we are dealing with is a cultural linguistic game, not in a pejorative sense game, but it is a game we play together. We speak to each other, we act in certain ways, and that is all invested with meaning for us, and we are comfortable. We are at home. The only problem is that if that is never challenged, never critically reflected upon, it can be a backwater that has no relationship to life that continues to go on. And so from time to time, it's good to say, is my language, my conceptuality, my symbolism, is that translated such that it throws light and grace on my present human experience? And that's what we're about here. I think I understand the nature of religious community. Finally, after a long, long journey and pilgrimage myself. For example, in the Grand Rapids Press yesterday, religion section, hell. Big, big lead article, colored picture of a clergyman with a wheelbarrow taking bricks away from the flames of hell. And then interviews of a lot of clergymen, even a retired systematic theologian from Western Seminary. There was only one person interviewed that dared say precisely and clearly where he was. It's a young Methodist fellow from Grand Rapids whom I know, who said, "I just don't believe in hell. I don't preach it. I don't believe in it." And I said, "Well, what if in the end you're wrong?" And he said, "I'll take that chance." Now, there aren't many in my profession that are that candid, frankly. Most of them were waffled about and were mealy-mouthed about, well, it's in the Bible no one suggested that one look at that whole doctrine of hell and come to see that it's a carryover from a medieval worldview. But what it essentially is saying is that life is important, life is serious, there is an element of judgment. You can say, use the words of Paul, you reap what you sow. The seriousness of life, moral responsibility, all of that is involved in that doctrine, but to literalize that biblical doctrine out of an ancient book, given all the horrors of of Dante in the medieval period, and to literalize that today and not simply to say, look, this is what's going on here. I think it's to be irresponsible, and it doesn't help to bring the people along of God along to come to understand the nature of religious language and symbolism and just the nature of religious community. I got a call this week from a Grand Rapids Press reporter, and obviously I haven't learned yet not to talk to reporters. But I couldn't help myself because she had a really good question. She said, what does it mean to be reformed in the 21st century? And I said, oh, that's a good question. To be reformed in the 21st century is to realize the heart and soul and spirit, the essence of the 16th century revolution. And she said, what do you mean? I said, well, the very heart and soul of the Reformation was that the church is to be re-formed according to the Word of God and always being reformed. The insight of the 16th century was that we are human, we are rooted in history, and a human rooted in history can never make an absolute statement because the landscape is constantly changing. And in the 16th century, they recognized the fact that every creedal formulation was a tentative provisional formulation in a present context that would have to be updated again and again and again. The church needed constantly to be reformed. That was a marvelous revolution, in spite of the fact that it rent the body of Christ. But that was the heart of it. That was the spirit of it. That was its soul. And in the 17th century, what they did is they absolutized that insight. And so it went no farther. And the Reformed churches, by and large today, live out of a 17th century paradigm of theological understanding. Absolutizing that as though that is an eternal truth universally expressed forever. When it's a wonderful insight if you live in the 17th century, connected to everything that they knew in the 17th century, but hardly able to carry the freight of a world that has exploded with knowledge as our world has today. So the young lady said to me, well, can you give me an example? I said, well, yeah. I said, it's a little hard today to be an absolutist and say I have the whole truth and nothing but the truth and no one else has the truth when we live next door and around the village with all kinds of other people of great religious traditions. And unless I'm willing to say I have a revelation of God and mine is true, and you say you have a revelation of God and yours is true, then I would say yours is false if I want to live that way. But who can live that way? What intelligent, sensitive person could live that way in today's world? So I said, this is an example of the Protestant principle that every historical form, institution, structure, creedal formulation is tentative, provisional, and always needs to be open to revision and reimagination. Oh, she said. Now, whether that ever appears, I don't know, and I don't really care. But it was good to get it off my chest. And I just did it again, didn't I? Well, the nature of religious community is such that those forms need constantly to be looked at in order that they may be translated into expressions that will bring to expression what they brought to expression when they were fresh and when they were new. Tillich, a great theologian, enunciated the Protestant principle, which is simply that we may absolutize no historical form. And that really ought to be clear. In our religious communities, though, we like to forget that, and we feel very cozy with one another as long as we're talking the same language and having the same sort of emotional highs. Martin Marty, the great church theologian, said the problem was switching denominations. The big downside of that is that you don't know the family stories and you don't get the inside jokes. It's true. When you're with your own kind, your own people, your own tight community, I mean, you know, it's like somebody can say number 10 and everybody laughs because you all know what that refers to, right? But that retranslation, the process that we've been through, the term I've used is not a good term. I'm not going to use retranslation anymore. I've tried to move ahead by using reimagination, to bring the imagination in, because what religion is about is not truth. It's about emotion and meaning. And this is a biggie. You say, you're telling me my faith isn't true? I say, is a sunset true? Is a poem true? Is there meaning? So to bring the imagination in is to imagine again the world and the human experience in the light of the stories, our religious stories. But even reimagination isn't the best word. I want to introduce re-enchantment. What I'd like to do for you as your religious leader is to re-enchant your religious understanding in order that your spiritual life may blossom and flourish anew. To re-enchant. I looked up enchantment in the dictionary. First meaning was from incantare, the Latin word, like incantation. And one of the first meanings was to mutter a magic chant. Well, that's what I do here. I mutter a magic chant, and you are enchanted. You're probably bewitched, bothered, and bewildered. But that's what's going on here. What we talk about here is not the kind of stuff you can go into a laboratory and verify. It's not the kind of stuff that you can literalize and historically verify. What we're talking about here is not empirical truth. It's not the hard truth of the natural sciences. It's not the softer truth of the social sciences. It's about meaning. It's about poetry. It's about language and images that are able to wash over you and make you feel love, joy, delight. Because another word of enchantment is to delight, to charm, to entrance. And a religious community needs to have its forms and symbols and language and liturgy constantly worked at in order that your ordinary experience of every day may be brought in here and enchanted. And you consequently enchanted in the process, charmed, delighted, filled with joy, going out dancing. That's really what religion is about. That's what religion ought to do for us. And when we literalize it, when we try to prove it, when we make it something that's verifiable, it's the story that counts. Well, the Jewish people have a story, a founding story. It's the Exodus. Recent Jewish scholars say that there's not a shred of empirical evidence, archaeological, historical, or otherwise, that there was ever an Exodus. Well, then does Judaism fall apart? Of course not. You don't need the Exodus. You've got the story and its effect. It's the story that affected all of this marvelous tradition in this wonderful Jewish community. That's what it's all about. We've had all kinds of historical Jesus scholars in here, and they've told us some valuable and important information. But finally, they admit, as we know, that you can't nail down Jesus finally in all of the dimensions of his life and his death and resurrection. That's not the kind of stuff of empirical verification. That's the kind of stuff of story that inspires and gives meaning to life. You believe it? You believe it? Of course you believe it, because it has come to be invested with meaning. If I found that there was no Exodus and there was no Jesus, I would still live the way of Jesus, because I can't find anything. And I think I have some legitimacy in saying that. I have not run up against anything. that has the compelling power to inspire and move me, like that which came to expression in Jesus. Walter Wink comes up and does a study on the Son of Man, which is the label that Jesus used for himself, which can be translated human being. And he comes up with this fresh sense that what the revelation of God in Jesus Christ is that God is human. Now, you know, in the tradition, in our language, our creeds, we've talked about incarnation, Jesus, the revelation of God, Jesus, the embodiment of God, see the face of Jesus, see the heart of God, all of that, sure, that's wonderful. And then we didn't go to the next step to say, God is human. And God comes to expression in the human. And it is the human to which we are beckoned. And as Wink points out, we think we're human. We're not human. We're fleetingly, fragmentarily, brokenly human. There's much of the animal still to manifest itself. And all of this stuff is really in the book. It's the treasures can be retrieved. It's just that the tradition has taken some things and left out other things. But for example, Psalm 103, God knows our frame. God remembers we are dust. This compassion, this wonderful image of a father who has compassion for his children. Earlier, the womb, the word for womb, used for God's yearning for God's children. This is in the Psalm. This is the Hebrew poet talking about the compassion of God. God knows our frame. God knows we are dust. Dust reminds us of Genesis 2. That's what triggered the Psalm. That's what triggered the poem. Genesis 2, God reaches down and gets a handful of mud and breathes into it. Ensouls it, and there's a living being. Well, so the human being is of the earth, earthy. Adam doesn't mean Mr. Adam and Mrs. Eve. It's Adam means mud. It means soil, earth. That first human was an earthling, and the dust of Psalm 103 and the mud of Genesis 2 is that poetic understanding of how deeply rooted we are in the earth. And the human is a word that comes from the same root as humus. And humus is decaying plant and animal life and excretion. It's the kind of stuff that after this rain, the worms will form up in your garden. To be human is to be humus. Someone went out and reminded me that it's also something you put on crackers, and I said, that's why I didn't like that stuff. Humus, that is. But the same root gives us human humility. If you're really a clod, you ought, by all rights, to be humble. Where do we get strutting like a peacock, as though we know everything, as though somehow or other, in all of our proud pomposity, we are the greatest thing that ever hit planet Earth? No, humility, humus, human, humble, and humor. We are a joke. We are funny people. And to the extent that we can look at ourselves, look in the mirror, and have a good laugh, to that extent we are sanctified, because we have been saved from our self-assertion and our self-aggrandizement, and we have recognized ourselves as on the way to being human, on the way to realizing the divine image within us, which is not to make us divine, flawless, perfect, but to make us human. And all of that stuff is in there. I think Jesus understood it. The wonderful story he told, which was read a moment ago, the father with two sons. Better a series of sermons than just this passing reference, but what a beautiful story. The son committing the human error, the human fall, turning back on home and family, coming into distress, coming to himself, like Nicodemus, being born again, born of the Spirit, aware suddenly, aware of who and what he is and where he belongs, concocts his little story to go home, hoping for a bunk in the back 40. And before he can get his story out, here's the father running to embrace, weeping, for all the father ever wanted was for the son to come home and be human. To be human is amazing, wonderful. To be human is to be flawed. To be human is to be a work in progress, but to be human is enough. No need of this drivenness, this obsessive, compulsive, religious drive to become something else. Because as I said last week, we humans are not God-damned creatures. All God ever wanted, the God who knows our frame, who remembers we are dust, all God ever wanted was for us to be what we are and continue to emerge into what we may be, human, and to come home. You may be simply clods, but you're all right.